I'm Fathery.
This is Dave.
And this is Text Trek.
Engage.
Big night tonight, the season one finale of Star Trek Discovery.
Yes, and then there will be no more episodes, I understand, right? This is it.
No, it's coming back in 2019.
Yay! Who knows what's going to happen between now and then, though. But yeah, they
all the actors could die in a plane crash.
Ah, don't say that. I take my dumb joke back. Everything's going to be okay.
North Korea could nuke Hollywood and kill all the writers.
That's going to happen. That's actually going to happen. you know, it's crazy, what a long, strange trip it's been. It's, thinking about when it was debuting, it's hard to kind of picture what the end game will be. And then we have made it through to the first end game and survived, and fandom has fought a little bit, I think is leaning towards acceptance. I don't know what the big picture is. And we've had a pretty fucking awesome opening season.
Yeah, I think we can agree that this is, out of any Star Trek spinoff, this is the strongest first season.
Yeah, I can't really see a strong argument. The only thing that I would maybe argue for is the one I haven't seen, Deep Space Nine, but even that I understood had to take a little while to find its feet.
Yeah, well, it's because they blew their entire budget on the pilot, and so you have a bunch of episodes after the pilot of people just hanging out on the station.
You know, there's something to be said for that. And just as an aside, as a little lead-in to this final episode, I was kind of worried it was going to be a hangout on the ship episode, that there'd be fighting amongst, like, Burnham versus Emperor Georgiou and all this sort of internal dissent, and that there would be some cool stuff where they'd be, like, down inside the tunnels on the Klingon homeworld. I did not expect even remotely, maybe because I did not watch the previews or trailers, I did not expect even remotely what we got, which was, in its way, closer to that first Enterprise episode where they go down into the that alien spaceport.
Spaceport
where there's shootout and all kinds of stuff.
Rigel 10.
Nice. That it was going to be... you know, break up into smaller groups, and they would talk about all sorts of other stuff while they were down there, and that there would be all kinds of interesting interactions with aliens, which we'll talk about obviously more as we go along. But we got the completed the, is it maybe triumvirate of core original series aliens that aren't Vulcans. So we've had Andorians, Tellarites. And now Orions. I'm probably missing one other one in there, but those feel like the big ones to me. Andorians, Tellarites, Orions. Any other ones? Horda, of course.
No, there's no Horda. There's no of those short gold guys in Journey to Babel that were getting caught with the blue cubes in their drinks.
Yep.
But
they hit the all of them, and they, like, I guess, arguably, the Orions got more screen time than the Andorians and the Tellarites have, but everybody showed for the party. So throughout the season, so there was all kinds of unexpected stuff in this episode, including a few plot points too.
Now, well, you seem pretty pretty happy about this this episode closing off the season.
It was actually I'm going to say slightly mixed, because it had the same problem that I've had with a few of the other previous episodes, which is a lot of stuff hit me really quick. And sometimes I didn't always 100% buy it.
Yeah.
Not something where I was like, so-and-so would never do that. It's impossible. It's ruined. But a few where I'm like, especially as we get to the finale stuff, exactly Laurel, her precisely how her thing worked, even though I was fascinated that, as I was kind of expecting early on, not early on, but a few episodes ago, she's going to be the Uniter.
Yeah, yeah, you called that, actually.
Yeah.
So,
in your face.
I've had a lot of predictions come true.
No, no, yeah. No,
check the tape.
Most of yours were screwy.
That's documented.
This is a major victory for people like me who do not think about the mysteries in shows much at all. I'm not a big picture guy, honestly. I kind of like to zero in on scenes and characters and stuff. So that was just more of a, it seems like if they want this character to have a further role in the show, then it has to be as the, she's the only Klingon left who's named to kind of unite.
Yeah, all those Klingons we met in the first episode, they've all died.
Yeah.
And I was thinking she would die in this episode.
Thank God she didn't eat the poison turkey or whatever it was.
Yeah, I would say my feelings on this episode, I found it satisfying,
mm-hmm.
Not perfect, but right. Satisfying. I had a few issues with it. Overall, though, I think I'm impressed with the first season.
Mm-hmm.
I think it did a lot of what it needed to do. And we'll just focus on this episode right now. I do want to say that a couple podcasts ago in Text Trek number 35, I believe. This is 37, mm-hmm. So I think 35 was when we were talking about the Star Trek cruise. I mentioned that I had a story about the night I was wearing the Klingon makeup.
Yes.
That I would share. I will share that at the end of this podcast.
Oh, nice.
If Dave reminds me.
A little bonus thing. But, yeah, we'll do it.
Yeah, we had a couple people ask about that.
I'm going to forget.
But we will move on and talk about episode 15 of Star Trek Discovery, Will You Take My Hand? Which I'm not really sure why that is the title of the episode.
So, that's... Is that supposed to sound like wedding vows? That sounds like a wedding vow to me.
Do you
take his hand in marriage or her hand in marriage?
Yeah, I don't know any other like times when I've heard someone ask that question.
There was something in this episode that was making me that I at some point I think I thought, oh, it kind of suits this scene, but I don't know. Like I might have to look and see if that has a context somewhere. Something from a poem or something from a story or whatever.
Well, let's recap the episode.
And we'll see if it occurs to us.
Refresh your memory.
Yeah.
Because speaking of poetry, the episode does kind of open with Burnham reciting what sounded like a poem that I was unfamiliar with. Where she's talking about the...
What was it? The anecdote
the
about
soldier,
the... Yeah.
The soldier and the general. And how will I know when I'm facing fear?
Right. She was referencing it as if it was like, this is a story that's a kind of a known story. I'm guessing it was like invented for the show though. Like, I don't think it's a, oh yes, people who've been through Marine training or Army training or whatever know this story.
Yeah. I was unfamiliar with it, but it did kind of give me the same type of vibe of something like the Charge of the Light Brigade.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was recited by, there's a hilarious moment in Deep Space Nine, which I know you haven't seen.
Familiar with the show, though. Space Station.
There's a key moment in the Dominion War where the Defiant is going into battle, and because everyone on Star Trek is just like has just read every piece of literature and can quote anything at any time.
Right.
They teach you good at Starfleet Academy. And so Dr. Bashir and Chief O'Brien start reciting the Charge of the Light Brigade as the Defiant is going up against
you get a very classical
Dominion fleet.
Knowledge. I bet they couldn't necessarily quote Game of Thrones.
Only things that are at least 100 years old now.
Right.
But, yeah, they're reciting the Charge of the Light Brigade, facing off against overwhelming odds.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're going into battle, Garak is on the Defiant, the Cardassian.
Mm-hmm.
And he asks them, so how does that poem end? It's like a you-don't-want-to-know type of situation.
Yeah.
But...
that reminds me of a bit on an old Cheers episode where somebody's likening themselves to John Henry, and somebody's like, what happens to him at the end of the story? And he's like, well, his heart explodes and he dies.
Yeah. But I don't know what the hell Burnham was quoting. It might have been something created for the,
right.
for the show.
One thing that doing opening like that, though, does is it suggests, it kind of gives some weight to the episode. There's like something... This is a weird comic book comparison. I'm going to do another comic comparison. In the old days, this happened more often. It doesn't too often now. But when something big was going down, some heavy shit, the Watcher would show up. And he would, like, say that, you know, this day we'll see a historical event or whatever.
Yeah, in Marvel Comics, the character of the Watcher.
Right, a powerful alien who only observed and would, although he broke it a few times.
Looks like a giant baby.
Looks like a giant baby, but yeah, his station was just to watch. Anyway.
Or in DC Comics, you'd have, what's his name, a pariah, the purple-haired guy?
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Whenever he shows up, you know.
He has to bear witness.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, when the Watcher would show, like, oh, some shit's gonna go down, when somebody kind of opens with that sort of reflective thing, when they're talking about a battle and overwhelming odds, some heavy shit's gonna go down.
But it did have a bookend to the end of the episode.
Right.
But, yeah, we see that there's a Klingon fleet ready to attack Earth.
Yep.
As the Discovery is racing to attack Kronos, with Emperor Georgiou in command of the ship.
Not really even trying to hide her mirror universe-ness.
Yeah, she's being super evil, super xenophobic, super hungry to eat Saru.
Right. Yeah, I did think that, like, because the Federation's plan was, we're going to pretend, like the higher-ups, we're going to pretend she's the real Captain Georgiou. She clearly, like, did not give a fuck and abandoned that early on. Because, yeah, is it Detmer? Or
yeah.
Somebody who, like, takes a scan of it? And she's like, such and such is the state...
Oh, no, that was, Owosakin?
Right.
I don't know. I can never remember how to say her name, but...
She refers to something about the state of their homeworld, and she's like, don't call it their home. They don't have homes. They have, like, nests or hives or something like that.
Yeah, animals don't have homes.
Yeah, like she's just horrible, and then, like, somebody else speaks, and she's just snapping at everybody, to the point where, like, Saru and Burnham are trying to, like, sneak some, like, are we fucked kind of dialogue on there? What are we gonna do? And she catches that, too. What happens right after that?
Well, she asks Saru if he's become tough, because scared Kelpian means tough Kelpian, and...
Oh, right, is she throwing out... Right, yeah, she's outright intimidating him with the fact that they cannibalized him. Not cannibalized, they ate him in the universe.
But he's trying to, like, keep the clever wordplay going, where he's like, yes, I've become very tough, some would say I'm unpalatable.
Right. So, yeah, he kind of gives her a nuanced fuck you.
But Burnham's not having this, and she tries to call Georgiou out on it.
So. Right, kind of challenges her in the middle of the bridge to, like, kind of, like, verify a memory of hers, like the specifics of it, which Georgiou is nothing if not capable and is able to correctly answer her bit of trivia about her childhood. Or their visit
growing up in Malaysia.
Yeah, their visit to Earth at one point. But she gets pissed that Burnham even tried it.
Yeah, and that's when she has the conversation, like, you know, don't try to out me again or I'll stick you in the brig.
Yeah.
Then they make their way to the brig and we see Georgiou try to interrogate Laurel.
Yeah. You know,
beating the shit out of her with her kung fu moves.
More than any other scene. Michelle Yeoh finally got to fully unleash her martial arts skills in this torture someone.
Yeah, just beating the shit out of a Klingon captive.
It's super messed up, yeah. Yeah, like, Laurel is, like, literally is, like, in chains, basically. It's space chains, mind you. Space body cuffs. But, like a tough-ass Klingon, she's, like... While she gets beaten and bloodied, is, like, laughing at it. She's, like, at the desperation of them. Of course, Burnham tries to stop her, but she's behind, Georgiou is immediately puts the field up, keys it to her voice, so Burnham kind of has to just take it.
Yeah, and what they're trying to figure out is...
Which is horrible. It's the first of what I guess will be many tests of how much Starfleet will tolerate, which is the major theme probably of the whole episode, is how much will they compromise themselves.
Interesting, yeah. But they're trying to get information from her about where to drop the drone that... basically, Georgiou and Burnham have the plan to go to Kronos, send, because they're gonna, as they established in the last episode, they're going to jump the Discovery to one of the caverns on the planet, where it will be hidden underground, and then they can drop a drone into one of the She actually called them chimneys into the, right. the volcano system.
Right. I think that's the I think that's the technical geological yeah. word for those kind of like essentially vents from
yeah makes sense
geothermal vents.
And they can use the drone to map the planet and see where all of the defenses are in Kronos and plan an assault on Kronos.
Right.
But they don't have really good intel on the planet. No one's been there in 100 years. Lorel's not going to help them. So they go to Ash Tyler, who has all of Voke's memories.
Right.
And I thought it was cool, like, seeing him in his quarters with... He has, like, all of these pictures of himself in Seattle. Which
yeah, yeah.
really wouldn't be him. They would be the true Ash Tyler.
Right.
Who we believe is dead now.
Right. But he probably has some nice digital photos of... that look like they... His memories are... Or they somehow got him to him or whatever. And I'm sure it's to help him acclimate to his status.
He still has, like, his tether fixation, which is now visualized in the rope he's tying a knot, some like type of sailor knot. That,
that kind of, by the way, you know what you do when you get married? You tie the knot. Yeah, will you take my hand? There's one instance of it. Now, given what happens at the end, the answer to that is kind of a big no. But... let's continue to keep a watch for it as we go through the episode. But it's hard to miss that he at least had that sort of feeling about her in the sense that mm-hmm. he will ultimately give that to her.
This is one of the things that I said a few episodes ago that would be a good idea to do, and that is use Tyler's knowledge of if he has the Voke memories.
That I actually was very much enjoying in this episode him dropping his Klingon side.
Yeah. And he lets them know that, yeah, the best place to go to get into the volcanic system would be if they go to where the Orion Embassy is on Kronos. They'd mm-hmm. be able to infiltrate the streets, and they needed to look for one of the shrines to Molor, who is a character in Klingon mythology established in Star Trek The Next Generation. He's basically like the character Cain from the Bible. He's basically like that in Klingon mythology. He's like the enemy of Kalus. It's like a bad Klingon.
I would think they'd kind of like Cain, but...
Well...
He's like a dishonorable kind of...
You can say he was Abel then, and Kalus was Cain.
Okay,
and
Cain won. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, there's like some people on Kronos, some Klingons apparently, who like... I guess there's like a Molor religion. So I guess they would kind of be like the Satanists. They'd be like the weird, like evil Klingons that are frowned upon in society.
Yeah, yeah. But... Extremist even among an extreme kind of people.
They had shrines that were used to toss living sacrifices down into the mm-hmm. I guess, lava, because it's a volcanic system.
Yeah, yeah.
So they need to find one of these shrines near the Orion Embassy. That's the plan. And they have a guy who knows a lot about Klingon culture, because he has a Klingon's memories. But Georgia wants another person on the team. She wants to recruit Tilly, because she apparently was buddy-buddy with Captain Killy in the Mirror Universe.
Right. As soon as she did that, I was like, they're not going to kill off Tilly, are they? Because I'm like, Georgiou, it seems like the, in some ways, more dangerous than Lorca, but mostly I think just because she is a known threat at this point, and where he was unknown most of his time, and seemed most dangerous only when he was fully revealed. But she has basically been fully revealed to us. We know how dangerous she can be. And she... The fact that she wanted to bring her along, I'm like, oh man, she's going to use her as leverage, hostage, something like that. She clearly will not care if she gets killed. And I was like, don't kill Tilly.
I'm still not crazy about this idea that Admiral Cornwell thought everyone on the Discovery who didn't know that Georgiou is from the Mirror Universe would buy this story about they found her as a survivor.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that they didn't, like, keep Tilly in the dark about that, like... Or else the character would have come off as very stupid. Like, she figured
it
out.
Right, right. I forgot. There is a... It's comedic, though. Like, she's like, oh, she's not... You know, she, like, kind of does that thing. Was like, that's not Georgia. You're the Emperor. Yeah. So it's kind of comedic at first when she recognizes it. It's a very Tilly moment.
Yeah, that's a good bit of writing, because you don't want to ever have characters verbalize a bunch of information that the audience already knows.
Right.
So whenever you can convey it in like a shorthand like that, it's...
Yeah, yeah, she was actually probably the perfect person to do it, because she's kind of like, oh, okay.
Well, I'm really curious about like what kind of shenanigans they were getting into in the Mirror Universe. And Georgiou even like talks about like conquering the Betazoids.
Yeah,
and exterminating Mintaka 3, which that's the planet from the Next Generation episode Who Watches the Watchers that have the Proto-Vulcan Society.
Oh, interesting.
So in the Mirror Universe, that planet got wiped out by Giorgio and Kelly.
Do you think that was like an atheistic purge? They're like, we don't want to. Well, but they're actually any Vulcans, I guess. They're just like, whatever. It could occur to me that like in the they might have been like, yeah, we don't want a bunch of superstitious Vulcans floating around. But then again, I would imagine that. Actually, it could have been like Vulcans are of use to us.
There was a pre-industrial society, so right.
Yeah, I imagine that they were just like, well, these are cavemen, let's burn them.
Yeah, why not? But they get their disguises to go down to the Orion Embassy, which they talk about how the Orions in the Mirror Universe are just as terrible as they are in the Prime Universe.
Yeah, that was interesting. Slavers and malcontents and all that stuff.
When they get these pirate disguises, which I thought looked pretty cool.
I always like it when they do that. It reminded me a little bit of whatever the Next Gen episode was where they got their little black jumpsuit so they could go infiltrate. Only, I believe this was the first part of the one where Picard gets captured and tortured. Didn't they precede that with, that was a two-parter?
You're talking about the Chain of Command where he gets tortured by the Cardassians?
Yeah, but wasn't that preceded by an episode that was kind of more about their infiltration?
You're mixing that episode up with another two. You're combining that with the Gambit.
Wherever they had to go to when there was like that Klingon opera going on and all that.
Yeah.
Okay. I am mixing it, but do you know what I'm talking about? They had like the black jumpsuits, very different, obviously, than their usual bright colored Star Trek uniforms.
They wore black when they had like their like special ops suits when like Worf and Crusher and Picard had to go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was different than when like Picard had to like disguise himself as a pirate in the Gambit. Part 1.
And the Gambit is what?
That's where, like, Picard joins, like, this pirate crew.
Man, I don't remember that episode at all.
But
anyway, my point is...
I think that's the one that you're remembering, but you're, like, you're combining it with Chain of Command.
I probably am. Anyway, like, but if it's... When you've got these guys who traditionally are in uniforms, and they kind of go covert like this, it's usually kind of cool, is the broader point. I can't help but notice that only Tilly got the cleavage-revealing outfit... But I could not argue against it.
If you had to pick one of them.
If I had to pick one. It was that or Saru.
And then when they arrive at the streets of Kronos...
There's a beautiful pan down, a shot that, by the way, that starts in the outer atmosphere of, like... Or maybe even, yeah, an outer atmosphere of, like, of Kronos... And goes the camera tracks down all the way to the surface level, like to the continent, to the cities, and you see that kind of rocky volcanic structure, and then it finally zooms in on like an alleyway as they beam in, and I was like, that's a cool shot. There's your money at work, people.
Yeah, and we do see the Discovery, you know, jump into the cave.
Another cool shot. Lots of like little retro rockets firing to stabilize them, and Stamets getting a little cocky about like, yeah, I did that.
And I was curious why they couldn't just jump the Discovery into one of the, like, volcano chimneys. And I guess those are all too small for the ship to fit into.
Probably so. I mean, yeah.
I wish they would have, like, articulated that so I didn't have to just, like, kind of make an excuse for them. But...
I mean, they're like, you know, it's geology. There's not, like, ship-wide vents on the Earth. So why would there be any on Kronos, you dumbass?
Yeah, let's skip past that. Get to the Orion shit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love seeing a bunch of Orions. It was weird because we've seen men Orions in Enterprise before, and they were always like bald and super muscular.
Yeah.
So I always thought like the thing with the Orions, because we've seen the Orion women who are always, you know, super sexy.
Right. They're the sexy pheromone spraying. Depending on whether you buy into Enterprise's, I guess, retcon. Are either, like, we're once actually kind of controlled society, and we're only recently deposed, or they've always been kind of, like, slave girls and stuff.
But, yeah, I always thought, like, okay, but, like, the women are, like, super, like, sexy women, and then, like, the men are, like, super hyper-masculine.
Right.
But I kind of like what Discovery did with them, where it's actually, like, well, no, like, there's a bit more variety.
There's more parody in there. Yeah. They were doing some kind of what I can only describe as Orion Cirque du Soleil, and like the naughty Cirque du Soleil. I forget which one that is, but the one with more ass cheeks in it. So they were like doing erotic dancing and stuff like that, and we're clearly kind of prostituting out men and women alike throughout.
Yeah, they were Orion slave boys.
Yeah. I don't know. Incidentally, that one does seem to fight canon. I'm actually perfectly fine with them broadening that, but it doesn't quite fit what we've seen. You know, what do you think about that?
I think it fits.
I mean, you yourself just said, you know, I mean, generally, very broadly speaking, the men were the slavers and the women were the slaves, and it was kind of this decadent fantasy, even going back as far as, like, what was it, the cage.
Yeah, but you would think you would want to have slave boys also. Like, you know, there's a whole demographic there that you can cater to. With.
You know, you're saying boy, but, like, this guy was, like, in his 20s. He's a slave man. He was a slave man.
We call him slave girls, not slave
women. I know. For some reason, though, when you say boys, I'm like, well, it wasn't, like, a 12-year-old. Just so you know out there, I mean, I presume you've watched the episode.
Yeah, I don't think any of these were... I don't think any of these sex slaves were minors.
A sex lad. No, anyway. But yes, have we ever seen the men at all in any Orion story presented as the object of sexual gratification?
Yeah, possibly in like a novel somewhere, but not that I'm aware of.
So that's a big change.
Yeah, and it makes sense to me.
But like, does it fit what we've seen?
Yeah, I don't see why it wouldn't. Like,
because okay. So I'm playing devil's advocate here because I don't really mind it at all. In fact, I think it's probably a good idea since that one was rooted in kind of like sex fantasies of like not just the 60s, but like going back to kind of like the topless women of Mars the nude women of Mars and the old John Carter novels. From, like, what, the 20s? Were those written? Anyway, there's always been a thing of, like, well, we wouldn't do it on Earth, but these alien civilizations make their women so sexy and, like, dance about, and they use them like this, and who are we to judge their culture? And they kind of... So, yeah, you get Pike fantasizing about slaves, which is pretty weird. and John Carter teaming up with naked women. It's a pulp tradition. It's probably best for Star Trek to be moving past that. So I'm glad that they did it. I just don't see how it fits continuity. Literally never seen it before. And suddenly it's just the case.
Because we haven't seen that many Orions. And so you would think that like people who have like...
Well, that's like...
Here's like our sentient living sex toys, basically. Like you'd think you'd have like boys and girls for that. Just like when they were making Star Trek in the 60s, they wouldn't show the boys, they'd only show the girls, because they didn't show gay on TV back then.
Right, right. The entire ethos of the 60s was no homo. at least public or in like mainstream. So anyway, yeah. I think that's a good way to kind of describe, yes, probably the reality of it.
And we should also say that the sex labs, they weren't all for like... For gay men, like they're always like where women can be the purchaser of a sex person,
right? Captain,
we're spending a lot of time talking about like sex workers.
No, it's
on
an interesting
Star Trek,
thing because it's also it also evokes canon issues and continuity stuff, which for some people is like the central sticking point for this show. So I think we're in fair territory here. For the record, evil George Al, who gets just scarier and scarier as the episode goes on. Did show a level of equality in sleeping with a guy and a girl, which had to be tough for her because she hates anybody who's not human, right?
Yeah, but you can...
Right, right. She was the same way that they would have used slaves in the Civil War or, like, during the era of slavery.
We're getting into some, like, really dark territory.
All right, I'm sorry, but look, that's what Star Trek makes you talk about, and that's okay.
Yeah, just...
The show is dark...
The Emperor of the Terran Empire is okay with sex slaves.
Yeah, yeah, clearly. Yes. All right, so anyway, we can talk more about Orions at some later date.
There were other aspects of the Orions that we saw, like street vendors.
Yeah.
They bought some Nausicaan firearms from one.
There was also an amusing
the Gormagander meat.
And a little inside reference of some SETI eels were either for sale or for eaten somewhere.
I didn't catch that was SETI. Is that what you were trying to tell me earlier?
Yeah,
I thought you were trying to like describe like your, because Dave has been sick for like
for the rest of my, like, for the last decade.
Go listen to all of our last like 10 podcasts. He's like coughing his lungs out.
Yeah.
I thought you were trying to tell me like that was like your what you were suspecting was the cause of your sickness was city illness.
No, the camera did a pan across one of the very first shots of the street vendors. So there was a pan that had a fish in it, and to its side were two beetle-like things, which looked like the little baby city eels. Actually, not like the little ones that went in Chekhov's ear. They were a little bit larger.
Like the adult ones?
It was like somewhere in between. You know, I'd almost have to double-check and make sure it wasn't like... You know, what were the ones that, like, from Picard's era that people would eat and they would turn into evil monsters? You know what I'm talking about? They were taking over the whole Federation.
In Conspiracy?
Conspiracy. And then they completely abandoned the plot line forever.
Yeah.
But it might have been those. I definitely, like, immediately saw it, and it looked either like a smaller, like, you know, that size version of the big old mama city eel, or it might have been those things that people ate in Picard's time for snacks. Anyway, we'll go back, and we'll have to verify that.
But I love the gag where where Tilly is getting something to eat, and she's like, oh, this is really good, and it turns out it's the endangered species... Space whale. Yeah. We saw a few episodes ago.
Oh,
the
right.
The Gormagander.
Right. Like, oh, right. I forgot that's what it was called. Yes, yes.
But they do make their way into this brothel.
Just real quick to finish your thought, when you were talking about the variety, there's also a fairly entertaining, kind of creepy drug using Orion.
Yeah, that's in the brothel.
After
they get into there. Yeah, you know who played that guy?
No, he seemed familiar.
It was Clint Howard.
Oh shit, Clint Howard of like all kinds of
Ron Howard's brother.
Ron Howard's brother, lots of weird stuff.
He's probably in the Han Solo movie.
Oh man, yeah, I'm sure. But best known as the true form for Trekkies of Baylock?
Baylock from the
Corbomite
Maneuver.
For his slightly quirky looks.
And he also played like a homeless hobo on Deep Space Nine. We went back in time to the 21st century.
Yep.
And he was a Ferengi on Enterprise.
Ah, nice.
So
nice. He has a long tradition.
Yeah, this is his fourth appearance in Star Trek.
All right, let's pray continue.
Yeah, so we have like Tilly is supposed to be guarding the probe. Giorgio is having fun with two Orions.
Right. Ostensibly, everybody split up and get information. We need to find out where the temple is.
Tyler is playing like a Klingon dice game.
I love the scene where he falls in with the Klingons and just starts like hanging out with them. It was also built to become traumatic for Burnham for specific reasons, which she'll outline later. But was also for just in general, it was hanging around a bunch of kind of Klingons, and she doesn't like Klingons. They killed her parents. At the very least, we already knew all that stuff.
Yeah, and the dice game he's playing is called, I think it was called T'Sung, and it was Klingon for obliterate them.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a fun game that Klingons would play.
I was kind of just amused at like how casual he gets into it, where he's kind of like hanging with them. It did sort of look like fun.
Yeah, I would go hang out with those Klingons. But, and I gotta talk about, like, they did confirm that Klingons do indeed have two dicks in this episode.
Was that definitely a Klingon against the wall?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because that was something that Lorca had said earlier, like, we don't even have the right number of organs for you. He says that to Laurel.
Uh-huh.
So, Worf has two dicks. And which, that says some interesting things about both Counselor Troi and Jadzia Dax.
Incidentally, the method by which we learn this is a Klingon's peeing on a wall and there's double streams. Did he cross the streams? That'll cause an implosion. I feel like that's the dark territory.
That's
the dark territory of this podcast. That's not where I want to go.
That means that when Voke got converted to human form, he gave up one of his dicks.
Maybe it was subsumed in it. I'm just going to point out, this is getting really weird. But, like, the clitoris has the same kind of nerve endings as a wang. and so maybe they just, like kind of, like, shrunk it down into... It's a possibility. It might still be there.
Yeah.
In a different form.
I think you just cut it off.
I'm going to apologize for some of the weirdness of this episode in advance. Who knows where it'll go from here.
But... Speaking of weirdness, we did have Tilly getting high.
She gets wasted
on the whatever that he explained. It was like a volcanic
Oh, yeah.
Narcotic.
Yeah, she inhales this thing from the little brazier of smoking
stuff. Clint Howard.
From Clint Howard, basically to maintain her cover, like, so she doesn't get booted out or whatever of the little vice den that she's in. And also gets some key information while she's high and has to, like, report back to Burnham while she's kind of wasted.
Yeah, Burnham, who just had...
It was actually, I thought, a nice bit of levity in an otherwise pretty serious-ass episode.
And Burnham had just had, like, a traumatic flashback to...
Yeah.
Klingons... Last time she heard Klingons laughing was when they came to her house as a child on Alpha Doctori, I think was the name of the colony. And it sounded like they murdered her dad, raped her mom to death, and then ate at their dinner table while she's, like, hiding in a cabinet as a kid.
Yeah. Yeah, these sort of clear implications seem to be probably sexual assault of her mother. There's your dark, probably the darkest territory of the episode. It's weird to think about that being the worst thing when you're talking about the potential, genocide of the Klingons, potential loss or destruction of the entire Federation. But personal stories are what we care about and show and watch these shows for. And so her personal story kind of carries more weight than all of that stuff. So, yeah, it was pretty grim. And Ash is fully aware of, like, how horrible that must be. He's like, no, you have to, you know, you have to be always hate them or whatever. He's like, I understand that. They also, he voiced in that sequence where she's telling him this, something that, like, I guess it's obvious, but I hadn't quite considered it, which is that now that he is, you know, they said early on that one of the themes for this first season, even though it's one I don't think they fully pulled off, was to get us inside the headspace of the Klingons, why they believe what they do, why they're doing what they're doing in the war. He's like the living embodiment of that middle point between Federation ideology and Klingon. He can remember, but now that he's, like, can have access to all the Klingons' memories, but his Federation and his heart.
Yeah, he says that he sees it from both sides.
Yeah.
Like, you know, literally, he knows how both sides think and feel.
Yeah. Which has got to be a little bit weird, because I'm like, oh, so you see it from the side of the hyper-xenophobes? Did they ever sell the Klingons' motivation in this first season as anything less than kind of ugly and destructive, xenophobic?
Well, Takuvma's whole philosophy was to unite the houses.
That's true. And he took his at Valk as his second, who was himself kind of an outcast.
Yeah.
So I guess he might have been sort of forward thinking, but yeah, it was. And he seemed to fear, like, the Federation wanted to one world government them, right? To unify everything and make homogenize.
Yeah, he was basically like a stand in for anti globalism.
Right.
And that is how a lot of, like, these, if you talk to people who are, like, former neo Nazis,
yeah,
people who were part of hate groups but then got out of it, you know, a lot of them do say that they kind of felt like an outcast, an outsider. And then, like, they found out about, like, these people, they get introduced to this, you know, things like white supremacy, and, you know, it makes them feel, I guess, empowered, and, like, they belong.
They're a part of something, so there's somebody who's got their back.
Yeah, so a guy like Boak, who's been treated as, like, an outsider his whole life,
right,
would probably gravitate to something like that.
Yeah. So he kind of voices that, and I guess his that side of him will become very relevant for the very ending.
But this is also where Burnham says, you know, now that she can see Klingon society and see that it is, like, you know, the Emperor is wrong. It's not that this isn't a home. It is, you know, like, these are people.
Right.
It's kind of weird because it was like a super shitty part of the planet. You would think that there are probably, like, nicer parts of Kronos.
Right.
And she's like, oh no, like, look, this is nice. These people are, like,
well,
doing drugs and passing out in the street. And,
right.
You know, we can't let you know, just, like, destroy them. Like,
You know, I think the broader point was, like, she did say something like, they have families in their way or after a fact or something like that. I think it was like a recognition of something that she was not able to do. She, just like Kirk in Trek 6, because of events in Trek to Earth, Trek 3, saw the Klingons as something less than human, that something less than sentient, basically as animals. And she had been struggling with that the whole since first episode, and this has been her arc to kind of recognize that they're still sort of people. You probably maybe should have had, like, I don't know, like a family somewhere in there that wasn't like in the drug den, just to kind of like cement.
This wasn't
that.
A family friendly.
No, but it, like, but nor
Klingon
was there.
Klingon,
like,
children don't go hang out at the Orion Embassy.
Nor was there like vile like murder going on everywhere. There was gambling and stuff like that, and drugs and like, but you know, like the street vendors were just street vendors.
It was
just going downtown and getting snacks.
It was a healthy level of debauchery.
Yeah. By the way, I did wonder, as xenophobic as the Klingons were presented in this season, I was like, they have embassies on their planet?
Orions. So.
Yeah, I know. I just had a little bit of a hard time. Like, I was like, I don't know if they'd even let Orions on there. It's that could be a practical thing.
There were some humans there, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Which I thought was weird that one of the Klingons even asked Tyler, he says, what are you doing here, human, spying for the Federation?
Yeah.
And they established, like, well, only, like, lowlives, like Harry Mudd would yeah. I mean, they didn't name check him, but, like, people like him, those types of
you
humans
think the Federation
would
show
up
like,
there.
We're going to give you 5,000 credits if you'll tell us what you see.
Yeah, you would think that they actually would send a Federation spy to Kronos.
Yeah. And maybe they have, and there's stories to be told there. It's like, it could be that the overall, like, defenses and stuff and scanning and such is that you can't get in with any kind of tech that they're going to spot it, and they'll kill you in a horrible way. It could be most people are too scared to do that. You know, the kind of the equivalent of, yeah, I'm going to go undercover with the most violent, horrible gang in the world. You could argue
Section 31 guy would do it, or would be shady enough. He would force someone else to do it.
Yeah,
but
maybe so. It's something that one of those points that would have been nice for them to kind of in some way address, maybe, but not part of the. It's not an important part of the bigger picture story they're telling right now. So whatever might have been the case, they didn't do it.
But while they are in the Orion brothel.
Yeah.
That is when Tilly finds out that the volcanoes are active. She realizes it's not a drone that she has, it's a hydro bomb.
Yeah.
So she informs Burnham. It's like, it looks like the Emperor Giorgio plans to cause a chain reaction in the volcanic system that would kill the entire planet.
Yeah, super volcano plus like kind of the like a nuclear winter because of, like, the ash cloud that'll, like, within weeks kill off the whole planet.
Well, that's going on. Giorgio, done with her Orion sex workers, basically, like, forces them to tell her where one of the volcano chimneys is.
Yep.
She takes...
When you say it like that, it doesn't sound super cool.
She takes the bomb from Tilly and proceeds to drop it off And Burnham and company realize, like, oh, this is actually the mission that Starfleet sent us on, and they're going to commit genocide.
Right.
So they go back to the ship, and they talk to Admiral Cornwell.
Yep.
And this is where
I told you Sarek was in on it, by the way.
Yeah, which kind of disappoints me, and I'm kind of disappointed that Admiral Cornwell was reduced to a badmiral.
Yeah, she was almost like what Lorca seemed to be in the first season, a any-means-necessary military commander.
But I do love that this gives Giorgio and Saru and the rest of the crew the opportunity to be like, no, like, we're Starfleet, we stand for these principles that we're not going to betray. And she even says, like, you know, I was wrong way back in the first episode when I commuted a mutiny to basically go against our principles and fire first. And then she's essentially saying, like, you know, I'm the goddamn mutineer, I'll mutiny now. But instead of mutinying against principles, it'll be for principles.
Yeah, yeah.
And Saru backs her up. He's like, right. Yeah, we're Starfleet. That's how we're going to do this.
Yeah, it's as much as his speech was two episodes back.
Yeah.
It was a statement of principle. And, it didn't have quite the resonance that sequence did two episodes ago for me.
Well, it was also a lot briefer.
Right, and I suppose, like, we had already had some sense at that point. Well, at this point, we already kind of know they're moving that direction, so it wasn't sort of so potent. But it was still, I liked seeing it. And I also hope would hope that it resonates with fans who, you know, shared some of the concerns I had early on that the show wasn't Star Trek enough, didn't embody Federation ideals enough.
You know, that's certainly still, the arc they were building to.
I'm still weirded out, and I guess they're going to get detoured based on events at the end. I'm still weirded out that Saru did not get essentially promoted to the captaincy. I guess that's not really how things usually work outside of movies.
Yeah, I'm okay with that, and I got something to add to that when we get to it.
Okay, all right.
But
it's really the kind of final standoff that occurs, for some reason, also felt a little... The suspense was not as high as I would have liked.
Giorgio and Burnham at the volcano hole.
Yeah, she's like, well, I'm about to go set this off.
Yeah, to detonate it.
Right, and like it didn't feel that tense. Like I did really like, I don't think she's going to do it. Although they did trick you a little bit when they came back from a commercial break and they showed all those volcanoes going off and then they kind of pan back and it's like, oh,
it was a simulation. Yeah they were showing to Cornwell.
That's cheap. Star Trek Discovery, that's cheap.
But this is really the climax of the entire first season. Yeah. And with that kind of weight attached to it, it does feel anticlimactic.
Right. Burnham almost seemed a little, I didn't feel like she, like, showed, like, the full... I felt like she should have been more emotional, honestly, about what was going to happen.
And we should talk about what was actually going on, was that... She stops Giorgio at, like, the edge of the volcano hole. Giorgio has, like, the iPad with the detonator on it.
Right.
And that's coded to her DNA.
Right. I'm sure, basically, what's-her-name's got the... She's got the drop on her with a phaser, right? Burnham?
Well, it ends up with Giorgio having the phaser pointed at Burnham.
Her. Right.
And Burnham basically says, I don't believe that you'll shoot me. You know, if you
I
do,
would not have taken that gamble, by the way.
Well, it was that married with, the entire Federation's going to come looking for you.
Yeah.
If you genocide the Klingons, we'll never stop looking for you.
Yeah, the one thing you wanted out of this, which was your freedom, you're not going
to
get.
Yeah. And so they do let her go, which is an interesting thing to have in Season 2. We have this evil Terran Emperor on the loose.
Man, I felt like that, she on the her on the loose... is basically about as dangerous as the entire Klingon Empire was in this first season. I would not have let her go by any means.
Yeah, and that's kind of like a questionable thing, and it seems like kind of a convenient move.
Yeah.
But I am glad that there is the potential to bring her back in season two.
Yeah. It'll be interesting. I liked her. I definitely... there's an interesting scene where Burnham says what I kind of suspected all along, but I couldn't tell if they were going to have her kind of go through a change. Burnham was like... There's very little that connects you to the Georgia I knew.
Yeah.
And she's like, you're right, basically. And I'm like, yes, you probably should have figured that out before. Federation definitely should have guessed that putting the fascist emperor in charge of their ship, maybe not a good idea.
But when you need someone who's going to commit genocide, and when, Saru just gave like that big speech,
right?
One else on the ship will do it.
Per what the from what we knew that Cornwell and Sarek wanted, which was an emergency end to the war. I guess it was there. They were willing to make the deal with the devil. We've talked about this off mic. I can't remember if we've talked about it on. It reminds me of the moral decision you have to make in the first or second Mass Effect relating to the Krogans, the highly proliferating warrior race that would have that were on that same march to take over the galaxy until a virus was introduced that essentially sterilized their race, like one in a thousand births continues, and so they just can't proliferate so fast, so they stagnate. It's a horrific, horrific thing, but... if you're right on the verge of losing to a warmongering race, then is that the right thing to do? You know, would you take those steps? Arguably, what I kind of like is that the Federation traditionally in Kirk's era, Picard's era, I know they had to deal more with compromises in Deep Space Nine. In Kirk and Picard area, they generally do the kind of superhero thing, which is they are good enough that they find a way to not have to compromise themselves. They can kind of rise above that, and because they use their ingenuity and their humanity and all that. So they didn't have to. But it is an interesting question, maybe a lurking in the background of, well, is there something to be said for Sarek and Cornwell's perspective? Like, well, we didn't know you were going to be able to figure out all this cool stuff, and so this was our best plan otherwise.
Well, yeah, they basically do that in this episode. Like, the heroes do figure out an alternative.
Right.
And that is to give Laurel the power to destroy Kronos.
Yep.
And they basically install her as the ruler of the Klingon Empire. And Laurel gets her goal of having all the houses united, like her messiah T'Kuvma wanted.
Yep.
And they'll have to fall in line behind her, because if they don't, she can destroy the planet.
Yep. I didn't think that was quite presented the way I would have liked, because she was kind of like, I've got the iPad. And she's like, it's got the button on it. It was just, I was like, do they even know what that is? Like, you kind of said, like, this is a detonator. But, like, she could have held up a brick and said, this is a detonator. Like, I know that you don't want to have to go through the technical details.
Yeah, I don't want to watch, like, 5 minutes of Laurel, like having, like, a chart and a slideshow presentation, like, showing pictures of the bomb.
You know what I was thinking that she would do is, like do some sort of limited use of it or something like that. Set off a volcano, do some damage, blow up an old unpopulated city somewhere, and say, like, that could be the whole planet. I think I would have liked something like that, just a little bit of demonstration of it, because it was a little hard to buy the Klingons bending over for someone just showing
bending the knee.
Yeah, that they have an iPad. I was excited to see, however, my slight disappointment at that when you see the Klingon fleet getting in line behind her, I was like, oh, that's a wide variety of ships. I don't know that I quite per se saw a D7, but I saw some stuff that was much closer to that than we traditionally have seen on the first season of Discovery. And did you look at those ships?
They still look like a bunch of ugly ships.
We'll have to go back and rewatch. There was one in there that reminded me quite a bit of the Bird of Prey. The one that's used in a million of the movies.
Well, they do have the Discovery Bird of Prey that's been in a few episodes. It did look better from the angle that they showed it.
Discovery Bird of Prey.
Yeah, it's... it kind of looks like a Cylon Raider, actually, but...
Maybe that was the one.
I think so. I guess it looked better from this angle.
I think it was the most variety I've seen in their ship types. Like, it felt like it more clearly delineated the stylizations of the houses, and gave me more hope that, yes, they could, should they want, they could transition to more traditional Klingons, more traditional Klingon ships, etc. Or I can just pretend they're in the background somewhere more easily.
Did you buy that Laurel would call off the war?
That one's a little bit tough. She cared about unification more than anything else. They did make that clear several times. And, Burnham said, basically, they had already lost the war for unification, by kind of becoming those desperate tribes that were like, yes, they would take out the Federation, but they would never be unified because there'd be eternal, you know, politicking and infighting.
Well, they were also, like, having a rivalry over who can destroy the Federation the most.
Right. It was like they were becoming, like, much more, like, unkempt gangs. It was, like, becoming gang warfare. So,
I accepted it. I thought it worked.
I just think that, yeah, like, you could have made it more dramatically satisfying. I don't even know if I have, like, some, like, oh, by doing this it would have been better. It didn't quite have the punch and the... You want to think, like, oh, wow, that's... Oh, yeah, I can see why she would have to take it. I kind of wanted a little bit more of that moment, maybe, but it was all right. It was good. It was solid.
But yeah, I mean, you know, the basic idea that Laurel was frustrated...
I think I liked the first half of this episode notably more than the second half, which had a lot of resolutions, some of which I liked, some I was a little more...
Oh, that's the other way around. I liked the second half more.
Oh, really? No, you didn't like it, exploring the Orion colony?
That was when I started liking it. I didn't like the opening that, like, they didn't have... The plan was just to put the Emperor in charge, and Cornwell and Sarek were just gonna commit genocide, but when they do start wrapping stuff
there
up...
There was a little bit of something of the way Battlestar Galactica did handle things, that is to say the remake of Battlestar Galactica. And sometimes, like, you know, when they cut to, you know, when they had them all on the planet and there was, like, they were, the colonies were, like, taken over by the Cylons. I forget, was that on,
New Caprica.
New Caprica.
Yeah, season two.
Yeah, and,
first part of season three.
Right, and, like, Ty's wife, was she like outright like collaborating with the Cylons at that point? And he was like a resistance leader.
Don't give spoilers for Battlestar Galactica though.
Oh man, that's, they can't possibly contextualize it if they haven't seen it. They don't know who Ty is. Anyway, a lot of stuff happened. A lot of things moved forward. Apollo was married to somebody who I was like, what, that? No, what? They never had a real connection. Anyway, a lot of stuff happened that was dramatic, but didn't feel organic, which is, I guess, something I've returned to a few times as maybe my central criticism sometimes of the show, is that they'll do big things and I don't quite always buy them.
Yeah, it always seems to make the choice to go for whatever is the most dramatic.
Right. Which, but I totally get that broad impulse for writers, and that makes a lot of sense. I think I just want a little bit more polish to it, a little the trip there to be more one where I say, like, yes, this is the inevitable outcome, or, like, now that I see it all, it makes sense, even though, you know, I feel like looking at Game of Thrones, which we know was an inspiration for them, at least sort of on how they run things somewhat, very often when something big happens on that, it feels organic. Like, it feels like an earned dramatic sequence, an earned loss, a when somebody has to give up something horrific to kind of move forward, I feel like, wow, that makes sense. That's horrible, but it makes sense. And I just don't quite always get the make sense thing.
Yeah, but the other side of that, what I do like about the show is they don't draw things out too long. That it's... You know, something happens, and then they
move
on. A lot
happened in the first season, really. Yeah. Like, and in fact, there is a kind of a...
We got a lot out of 15 episodes.
Right. When things are resolved here, there's actually even quite a bit that happens in the... What would be the equivalent of the Star Wars Awards ceremony. Anything major to discuss between...
Well, we got to talk about Tyler.
Right. So yeah, we touched on this earlier... But he has a bombshell to drop on Burnham as to what he's going to do next.
Yeah, and that is he's going to go back to his, kind of his ex-girlfriend, Laurel.
Yeah.
But, he thinks he can serve the Federation and Klingons both the best by hanging out with Laurel.
Yeah.
And that does kind of make sense. Like, if he has any type of influence with her, he could probably, temper her enough to, like, avoid any... future major hostilities with the Federation.
What? So, I don't know where his jumbled memories are at now, but essentially, she was previously, in his head, his rapist and torturer in jail. There is something very disturbing.
Reconciled now. He sees like, oh, that wasn't rape. That was like consensual sex with her when I was Voke.
Right. They didn't exactly fully explain it, but that is what we do know to be the case. But he was also conflating it with his torture and stuff like that.
He wasn't tortured though.
That was his surgeries and stuff. His no anesthesia.
When he got his second dick cut off.
That's when he had his second dick turned into a Klingon clit.
I don't think that happened.
Oh my god!
That would like the Dr. Colbert would have like detected that when he was scanning on it.
That's true. It's like there's stitches here where it looks like a second dick was attached, but I'm not going to worry about that. I've got more things to deal with. right. So I think this was a dramatically good decision for the show because we don't know like what to do with Ash Tyler. They've kind of clearly like not been able to reconcile with Burnham. I didn't want to see him die. He could have stayed on the ship. As kind of an awkward, like, person, you know, like, awkward passerby in the corridor.
Yeah, but he couldn't work in Starfleet anymore. Like,
that's true.
Like, he needed to go, like, to a hospital somewhere.
They're probably not going to trust him.
He needed therapy.
He probably still needs therapy. Hopefully, that would have been nice if he said, I'm going to, like, get some help, and I'm going to, like, try and, like, unify the Klingons and the Federation people and help out with that. But I thought his decision actually did overall make sense. And was also good for the show.
Yeah, and I've talked about how I didn't really like Ash Tyler as much as everyone else seems to. But I did... So I got up this morning at 8 o'clock and binge-watched the entire season 1 of Discovery.
Yep.
All the way up to the finale.
Yeah.
And actually, like, after seeing everything again, I do like Tyler a little bit more now.
I actually liked him the whole time. I think we talked about this last episode. The problem was that he was, like, too kind of likable.
And, okay, so something on that. About what we talked about last week was when him and Burnham have their big breakup scene.
Yeah.
And Burnham says, basically, like, you know, fuck you, you told me that you would say something if you couldn't handle things. And, yeah. And we were thinking, like, well, that's kind of unfair because... Well, actually, like, if you go back a couple episodes before that, what they were talking about, the context to that is that... Mm-hmm. He's when he's having like his PTSD after he had the right. breakdown on the sarcophagus ship.
Yeah.
And she asks him then, because this is when they're about to go infiltrate the Mirror Universe Shinjo.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you know, are you going to be okay? Are you going to be able to handle this mission? And he's like, yeah, I can. And if it was too much, I would tell you. I promise right. I would tell you. But then, like, right after she leaves, that's when, like, he, like, breaks the glass he was drinking out of and cuts up his hand. And then, like, he clearly knew that something was wrong and didn't say something. So I can defend Burnham for being, like, you
There's
know...
There's the normal, like, you should have said something and you didn't when you're just, like, dating somebody and you don't tell them you're falling out of love with them or whatever.
But that's not the thing.
Actually had, like, an evil Klingon inside him that was trying to get out. But not a normal problem.
He knew something was wrong and didn't say anything.
Yeah, well, that's probably because the Klingon in him was like, don't say anything. You're a Klingon.
Like, that's the way it's presented was that like he knew something, but he was scared to say anything.
Maybe
and chose not to.
Yeah,
deliberately
yeah.
didn't say anything.
Yeah,
I can forgive yeah. Burnham for holding that against him.
Right. Actually, I could forgive her even before. I don't necessarily think it's wholly fair because he was in a unique situation as this weird hybrid man. But of course, yeah. But like, yeah, from her perspective, it does make sense.
And then we have
possibly from a real perspective too.
We kind of have a repeat. Closure scene between the two of them when he he doesn't tie the knot with her, but he leaves the knot he tied
for her.
Yeah,
right.
So
well,
they
it's
can,
sort of
they
like
can
you
be
could
tethered.
Say...
It's still like the tether metaphor. Like they still maintain a connection.
Right. There is still a knot in there, and also you can also see it as sort of a you know if you read it as well, she answered no to their coupling, their marriage, their whatever might have happened, then the knot is a remembrance of what that they could have had that was within grasp and that their love was true and all that stuff. They both clearly care for each other still.
So instead of calling the episode "Will You Take My Hand," it should have been called "You Could Have Taken My Hand."
Yes, "Will You Take My Knotted Rope?" Very literal.
But yeah, I mean that's pretty much everything until we have like the.
Epilogue with some little one very big thing that happens, and then a bunch of little promotions and things
yeah.
like that.
And I love that we see Earth because it's one of the things I wanted.
Gorgeous shot of Earth too.
Yeah.
It's a nighttime shot.
I wanted to see 23rd century Earth mm-hmm. at some point in the show, and it was in Paris. Which, if you remember from The Next Generation and Star Trek VI, that's where the president of the Federation. And also from Deep Space Nine. But yeah, the president of the Federation is located in Paris.
Oh, I forgot that.
So the president, we don't see him or her, but they do pardon Burnham.
Yep.
Which I was thinking was a likely case where she yep. has the mutiny expunged from her record.
For a minute, I thought they were going to say, we pardoned you, and also we gave you a captaincy, which is kind of how things work in like the movies sometimes. But they did not do that here. She got to, like... what did they gave her a commander? They returned her to her commander position.
Yeah, where she was at the beginning of the
yep.
the show.
Yep.
And well, she has that cool conversation with.
By the way, quick flashback to the conversation with Ash. I just forgot. I was like, when he said that he was going to go and rejoin the Klingons, I wanted her to kind of give him the like you play one game of gambling with the Klingons and you just run off with them, just kind of like
yeah.
nag him.
He wants to go like gamble with his Klingon bros.
Yeah, like you don't have to don't pretend it's to unify Earth and the Klingons or the Federation of the Klingons. All right, sorry, that was just a stupid aside.
We see Amanda again,
right? When I saw her, I was like, who this? I did not remember her immediately as the actress playing Amanda. I only know the original and Winona Ryder, and I'd forgotten that she played her mom. But from context, it became clear quickly. She had, I guess, called her there for kind of a little bit of comfort, right? She needed to talk to her.
Yeah, and that was kind of Burnham's arc through the season was like embracing her human side and kind of getting, like, the chip off of her shoulder that she had to, like, try. Kind of like the same thing with Spock. It's like, I have to try super hard to be logical and be, like, a good Vulcan because I'm not. And I got to, like, show everyone that I can be just as logical and...
Yeah, arguably her extreme logic in the first episode was what pushed her to kind of, like, I will do what logic dictates regardless of the kind of cost to the Federation's soul. And that like pushed her into the dangerous mutinous territory. And the logic actually had to be reined in and tempered, I guess, with humanity in the broader sense, not like only humans got it, but that, you know, an empathy.
Yeah, and I think that, like, talking to Amanda, her foster mother, it was that was kind of, you know, showcasing her, like, you know, coming to terms with her human side.
Right.
And then we have her conversation with Sarek, which this is where I kind of have a problem with the episode, where he's like, yeah, I did kind of want to, like, genocide all the Klingons. Sorry about that. It probably wasn't a good idea. And she's like, yeah, that's cool.
I wanted to
give
them the biggest Vulcan hello of them all.
I kind of didn't like that it's just kind of like that Sarek would do that, and it's kind of like brushed over.
Yeah.
She did kind of make a case for it, where it's like, well, you know, it's either this
or... You know, we've always known he's an ambassador. They've never said exactly... Like, he's famous, but like, you know, they didn't necessarily say that he might have not have made some mistakes.
Yeah. And he
genocide!
He is often depicted as an asshole.
Right.
And I guess if the times were desperate enough, that it was like, yeah, we gotta do something because the Klingons are about to destroy Earth, and Vulcan, and Andor are all about to get obliterated.
Who made the, in the game Mass Effect, who made the gene virus or whatever that sterilized the Krogans? Was it the, what the fuck are those aliens called?
I don't know. It's...
Like, it was, I think, one of their like, logical-type people. It was, like, the guy who's the doctor.
Yeah.
I think
they were doing it for someone else.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, that was, since it has a somewhat analogous situation, the, would you genocide another race to stop them from what seemed like an absolute one, you know, micro, you know, millimeter from taking over the entire universe?
I would say I think sterilizing a population isn't nearly as bad as just outright genocide.
You know,
there's a lot of people on Earth I want to sterilize now. But.
Emperor Georgiou herself said that like a few would probably escape. They wouldn't kill every single one.
Yeah, that's true.
That was kind of funny to hear her trying to like kind of justify it. Like, not every single one is going to die.
She said like they won't even have like a bunch of Terran ships shooting them if they're trying to escape.
Yeah, like they did in my universe. Yeah, it was darkly funny. But, yeah, overall, I agree with you. It was a little unfortunate to see Sarek compromised in that way. I think you can
make... But it is wartime.
I think you can make a case for it, and that, like, you know, the seeing, like, all that the Vulcans have built, all the Andorians have built, all the humans have built, all the other races of the Federation, the notion that they could actually lose it all might push you to that state. That you're not just might, but we're within like a day or two from losing it all. Maybe so.
Yeah, but I had a bigger problem with him than someone like Cornwell, who's just like, well, yeah, we see that in Star Trek all the time, that there's like a bad admiral.
Yeah.
That's a common occurrence. But with like a named character that we've known since the original series, it did kind of bother me. But at the same time, I was like, well, he kind of always is an asshole.
Yeah.
They did push the desperation here enough that I'll accept it. I don't really like it, but I'm not going to make a big deal about it.
Trek is ruined.
But
no going back now.
Yeah, it's just Sarek's a mass murderer.
You know where they don't mass murder people? The Orville. They just have misogynistic jokes and poop jokes.
Yeah, and a bunch of reused Star Trek ideas.
Yeah, but it's still kind of fun, and I like it. We're going to move on. let's talk about the award ceremony.
People get promoted.
People got promoted.
So it's not going to be Harry Kim on Voyager, who's an ensign for 7 years.
Tilly is in the command program.
Yeah, she's graduated from the academy, so she's an ensign.
Yep.
Stamets becomes lieutenant commander.
Yep.
He also gets... They all get medals of honor, and he gets like a little medal of honor for Dr. Culver.
Right, that was kind of sweet. Is it time? Let's talk about the ending.
And let's just say, like, this is where Burnham is like giving the rest of her speech with the poem, or whatever it was. So we do kind of like see like the context of that, and it kind of looked like it was like the room that Tyler Perry is in Star Trek 09.
What scene are you talking about?
In Star Trek 09, when Tyler Perry is like...
No, what are you comparing it to?
When the room Burnham gives that speech in...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is like the room that, like, when Tyler Perry is talking to all the cadets in Star Trek 09.
Right, it does.
I'm wondering if that's, like, the same location. Which I think would be kind of cool continuity, because that seems like that would exist in...
They've been making... In the Discovery book, and somewhat, I think, maybe on the show, the Vulcan, like... training pods or whatever that sound exactly like they're described in Trek 09.
We saw them in the
First episode. They basically they're keeping that one. It seems like it's become a bit of visual iconography. They'll stick with it.
You got to think like a lot of stuff would exist both in the Kelvin universe and the Prime universe. So.
Yeah, it's just that some people are just like, nope, not going to even talk about those movies. Not going to think about them.
Well, that's silly, but and then. Yeah, we do have the whole crew is on the Discovery. They're going back to planet Vulcan, where they're going to get their new captain, and Sarek is along for the ride. And as soon as they said they were going to Vulcan to get a new captain, this is what I was thinking, is like, please don't make, like, Spock the captain of the ship, and then, like, have some...
I was a little worried when Sarek stepped onto the bridge, I'm like, is he going to somehow captain the ship for a little while? I'm like, that's crazy that they didn't do that.
Yeah, no, but... It was just when they're saying, like, we're going to get our new captain, because I was like, okay, it feels like they're about to, like, drop a bombshell...
Right, something big is coming.
I was like, just don't, like, because my biggest fear is, like, they're going to try to shoehorn in some story between the cage and where no man has gone before, where, like, Spock was a captain and he commanded the Discovery, and then, like, somehow, like, he lost his rank and dropped down to a commander and became Kirk's first officer.
Yeah,
I was like, don't do that.
You know what my biggest fear was? It was that they would, like, that they weren't going to, like, say who the captain was before the season ended. They didn't. But it's because they had another bombshell drop, so I felt like I got a satisfying reveal.
And that bombshell was, as soon as I got a Priority One distress call, I started saying to my girlfriend that was watching this with me, I was like, oh, it's going to be Pike on the 1701. And then, like, the registry number started showing up, the NCC-17, and then you have someone says, like, oh, yeah, it's Captain Pike on the Enterprise hailing us.
Yep.
And the Constitution-class Enterprise shows up.
Yeah, we get to see it imaged with all of the fancy technology of our modern day stuff. It looks very cool. It looks both like it looks very true to the classic Constitution design, but made over a little bit in the slightly more gunmetal style, I'm going to say, of Discovery.
Yeah. And some people are going to go crazy about the way that it looked because it does look different.
Yeah.
I'm okay with it because there's really only like two big differences on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the pylons are a bit wider.
Uh-huh.
The nacelles have like the blue glowy lights on the inside of the nacelles, which, yeah, I'm going to go like super like nerdy, ship fanatic right here.
Yeah.
But Matt,
I'm kind of like nodding my head like, okay, he's crazy. And if I interrupt him, he might kill me. So pray continue.
Just real fast, you know, Matt Jeffries originally intended for the Enterprise to have the blue lights on the inside of the nacelles on those grills, but for some reason, like, that didn't work with the model.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought they would look cool, though, so I'm glad they actually put that in there.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have, like, the spiky tips on the end of the nacelles on the Blizzard collectors.
Their little fins.
But we only saw those in the cage, so, and also, they added a window to the bridge.
Uh-huh.
And I kind of don't like that there's a window on there.
Oh, it's
screen. I'm not crazy about, like, the windows on the ships.
I only saw this the one time and definitely have not done any still framing through it. My broad thinking was, this looks basically like the classic Constitution.
It looks good. I liked the look.
And it looks very cool. And they played the Star Trek music over the credits, the classic Trek music, which was crazy. But it looked pretty good to me, like... I have always understood that this show was going to remake some of the designs.
They never lied about that. They said that from the beginning.
Right. And from the beginning, we've had to deal with the fact that this could just be how Klingons look from now on. This could just be how Klingon ships look from now on. And we just had to see if the story would carry us. So yeah, this is about... I guess there's nothing more iconic, really, in, like... the Millennium Falcon, maybe, than the Enterprise.
No, I'd say the Enterprise is more iconic.
I think so, too. I feel like Star Wars has a bit of popularity edge is the only reason why I would maybe say more people know it.
Well, like, my sister, who isn't connected, like, anything pop cultural at all.
Yeah.
If I showed her the Enterprise, she'd be like, yeah, that's from Star Trek. If I showed her Millennium Falcon, she'd have no idea what it was.
Yeah, that's true. Be like, this is just some disc or something. But anyway, I was pretty happy with it, and I do want to like go through and still frame it just to kind of like see it better. I kind of agree with you about the view screen. That seems like in general, like I feel like there should only be like viewing ports and stuff like that from places like on decks where you're gonna like. You know, actually, it's meant to be a little scenic at times, or from their equivalent of 10 forward. And I feel like it should be a view screen on the bridge. At the same time, it all kind of, like, points forward. It feels like they're looking out a window sometimes, with enhancements, obviously, whenever they zoom in all the time. It is a little weird to think of it as a real window, though. Like on Star Destroyers.
But I can explain it that they just, at this point, the Enterprise had like a different bridge module installed, sure. Which is like
They got 10 years of retrofits.
Yeah, and they like changed the warp nacelles and they just like take the entire pylons off and put new ones on. Because we do know the nacelles change between where No
it's
Man's
It's just gone different, Father.
Between the cage and where No Man's gone before. So.
Yeah.
I made it work in my headcanon.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Whatever you gotta do.
Should we talk about, like, I guess it's, like, overall, now that we've seen the entire season.
Yeah.
What are your feelings on the whole thing?
I'm broadly very happy with it. Really like the characters and the tone of the show. The bridge crew has become, you know, early on, they were, actually, not the bridge crew, but the
principal characters.
The principal characters have become the crew that I wanted them to be. And that, to be honest, I wasn't sure if they were going to. I just didn't know if the show would prioritize that. I was like, I don't think it's going to be that kind of show. It's not about the kind of like coming together of a team of exceptional individuals to kind of like that would in some way be aspirational characters in the same way superheroes are, or the original many of the Star Trek bridge crews are, kind of where they're like, you know, you could see them becoming kind of legendary figures. But they, you know, even though that doesn't quite feel in the grasp of this, like, will Tilly become a legendary captain? I don't know, like we're not in Sulu territory yet. But they feel like they have that potential, and that, like, to me is maybe more Trek than anything else, is that sense of the crew as kind of like surrogate family, and as like experts in their area who can kind of beat the odds and kind of come up with the answers, short of the, and not have to genocide people. for all that stuff, I'm really happy with it. But also for its darker turns, it's moments of like bleakness and you know, Kelpian eating and stuff like that. I'm going to say my major complaint is probably, because it's the one thing I probably brought up the most, other than the stupid Klingon ships, is that sometimes the very big dramatic things happen kind of out of nowhere. Not out of nowhere, but I would like for them to feel like they emerged a little bit more organically. That's my big one. And it was honestly a complaint I had with Galactica when I was watching the show, too. Mm. So... Where are you standing on the big scheme of things?
Well, and I wasn't as skeptical going into the season as you were, mm-hmm. or at times you were, but...
Yeah, I should say early on, extremely skeptical. Like, first two or three episodes, I was like, uh-oh. Doesn't feel like Trek to me. Actually, it was literally the first two episodes. Third episode was where it started to gel. I needed to see the Discovery and the... And Burnham working with a crew.
And I'm in the same boat to an extent. Even it's funny now because I kind of enjoy going back and watching the first two episodes.
Sure, you can watch them with a lot less pressure. You can just kind of enjoy, like, oh, let's just enjoy some time with the Shenzhou and its crew. You know.
Yeah, and I would love. I would really, if anyone at Sarah Gatos, the editor of the Star Trek comics at IDW, if you're listening to this. I would really, really, really want a Shenzhou ongoing comic series about. Burnham and Saru and Giorgio on the Shenzhou and their adventures.
Yep, absolutely.
So I would buy a billion issues every month if you'll print that.
As an aside, they have done that to some degree in the first novel,
yes.
Which we're going to like actually talk about soon, and which clearly has a sudden bearing on things because it's about Pike working together with the Shenzhou.
Yeah. And we should talk about like what we're expecting for season two in a second. But yeah, just like
I'm reminding you now to tell your crazy story about whatever it was.
Okay. Well, let me tell my thoughts about like season one.
Yeah. Finish it up.
Okay. Then we'll talk about season two, and we'll talk about crazy story.
All right.
So, season.
This is an extra long episode.
My thoughts on season one, which is really, you know, the CBS described this as like, okay, we have the 2-episode prologue, and then we have chapter one of Discovery with like the Klingon War, and then we have like chapter two, which was the Mirror Universe, and then I guess like ending the war. Like really, really like the season, I can kind of break it down into like 4 different segments. You have like starting the war on the Shenzhou. Then you have 7 episodes of the Discovery and Lorca.
Engaged in the war.
Yeah, like fighting the Klingons. This is also where things are like more episodic, where you have like, let's go over to the haunted ship, and then you know, let's learn how to use the tardigrade.
Let's watch Harry Mudd kill Lorca about 100 times.
Have Klingon prison escape.
Yeah.
And then when they got into the Mirror Universe episodes, like the 4 episodes there, that was when I loved the show the most. And that was kind of the highlight for me. And so the last 2 episodes, while I was satisfied with the end of the season, it did feel like a little bit regressive, because the show had been getting like better and better and better each week. And for me, it peaked in the Mirror Universe. So it did kind of feel like a step back.
I kind of agree with that.
But having said that, I loved that Mirror Universe arc so much, because it was just so well produced. The action, the hard hitting drama moments that they did. It was super cinematic.
For me,
there
was also something of a nostalgic nature, in the sense that it took one of the coolest concepts that the original Trek ever gave the whole rest of science fiction.
Yes,
and they rethought it for a new era. They revisualized it. They kind of gave us new insights into how it might work. And they spent the most time, I guess, that any show has ever spent with the Mirror Universe. Did Deep Space Nine stay
as long? Deep Space Nine did 5 episodes, but they weren't, like, at the same time. They were spread out over 7 seasons.
Yeah. So, like, the most contiguous episodes, is that what you would say?
Yeah, most contiguous Mirror Universe episodes.
Yeah, so this was like a... Yeah, we really got to see it in all its ugly glory.
And they did what I want Star Trek to do the most, and that is... make it a story of today, of the present, of real world, and they made it super relevant to essentially what I wanted Star Trek to be talking about in 2017 and 2018.
Right.
And so with those 4 episodes alone, I feel like that merited the show being renewed for a 2nd season. And I feel kind of the way I feel when I walked out of the theater in May of 2009 after seeing the first J.J. Abrams movie, and that is... Yeah, some of that was a little weird. It wasn't the way I would have done it, but at least, like, right now, where things have ended, after, like, this first outing, everything is set up to do some really fantastic Star Trek stories going forward.
But you would probably say, I would hope, perhaps, that the Discovery felt more Star Trek-y than Abrams's thing?
Well, I think that they both have a lot of traditional Star Trek vibes, and also new things that traditional Trek didn't have. But they're very different from each other.
I'm going to have to wait until our full 2009 Star Trek discussion, because I have a lot to say about it. I had more issues with it, even though I have warmed to it a bit. But I get your notion here. I get your notion here is that it feels like Trek is back and has...
And some of it was kind of weird. Some of it wasn't what I was expecting. It wasn't what I would have done.
Right. Yeah, like... Well,
but it worked out. I like where we got.
So what do you feel about the darkness level, like the broad level of seriousness and darkness of Discovery, which traditionally has not been Trek, DS9 accepted? You okay with it?
I'm okay. I think that that's really cool when you can...
Not enough F-bombs?
I have no problem with the F-bomb. I don't think saying the F-word is dark.
I know. That's just it's code sometimes for when people.
I think someone in 2018 being upset about like someone saying fuck, that's the equivalent of like, well, someone in 1967
when Kirk said hell or something.
Yeah,
Kirk
said let's get the hell out of here.
No, like, but I gather that was a little bit of that was edge pushing at the time, and so this is just the new equivalent. Now they should go back and redub that. Let's get the fuck out of here.
In most English speaking countries, they don't make a big deal out of people saying the fuck word on TV like we do in America.
Yeah.
Also, they don't make a big deal about the nudity, like with the Klingon boobs that we saw.
Yep. This episode was big on butts.
I don't think a lot of
thongs on the Orions.
I don't think Discovery is too dark. I think sometimes you got to go in like this really dark, that really dark territory to like show your characters overcome that.
Right, and well, we talked about like it feels like the show Trek should reflect its times. I hate to say it, but we're in dark times right now.
Yeah.
You can argue with me about that, but you'd be wrong. And the world feels particularly unstable right now. If only because the rise of fascism everywhere and nationalism. I think Trek does need to reflect that. I'll be curious to see in season two, where the war is not hanging over their heads, what they choose as their new themes.
Well, let's talk about season two a little bit, okay. Because we do know that the show is going to include the 1701 Enterprise, so that pretty much guarantees we will see Captain Pike, mm-hmm. We will see Number One,
yep.
We will see Spock.
Sometimes called Una.
Yeah.
Probably so, because she's called that in the book. But, so they'll probably run with that, since they're more closely being canonical with books and comics right now. And yes, Spock.
And we did see, when the Enterprise showed up, Burnham and Sarek gave that look to each other. And they're like, this is a Spock ship.
Yeah.
It's going to be kind of awkward, because our family doesn't really get along all that well.
On a purely kind of continuity, nerdy level, I'll be fascinated to see if they drop the mentions of the book. And she says, I haven't seen you for, 3 years, I guess is it supposed to have been?
Yeah.
Since we dealt with that problem on blah, blah, blah. Rigel 3.
So, what we can expect to hear going forward is there's going to be an announcement on when the season will actually come out at some point. Yes. I'm guessing it's going to be early 2019, and that they'll want all of their episodes to get released before the Game of Thrones final season, which is probably going to be in April of next year.
Right, right.
So I think we'll get our entire season before April of next year.
Man, it's crazy. It's a crazy wait.
Yeah. But we had to wait 12 years to get this show, so.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we're also...
I can deal.
We're going to be getting casting announcements for these Enterprise crew characters.
So the biggies of which are going to be Spock and Pike. A little bit less so for Number One, but should be notable.
And on After Trek, they did talk to the showrunners, and...
They did keep this under wraps. I had no idea this was going to happen. Well, there was Jonathan Frakes didn't spoil this one.
Yeah, I don't think he knew about this one.
Yeah.
They probably kept him in the dark.
That's the key thing.
But
excellent director, maybe don't tell him the secrets, though.
But Aaron Harberts did say that, one of the things they're going to focus on in season two would be a science versus spirituality type of
story. That's interesting.
So, which, again, is some territory that Deep Space Nine covered a lot, but it does feel like a very traditional Star Trek story. Mm-hmm. And
it's such a key aspect of the world we live in, the world that we've had for thousands of years, that there's always going to be some new angle, there's always going to be some new way to frame it and lens it.
And it is something that is pretty relevant today.
Yeah.
And they've also talked about, they're going to focus on more...
Vulcans kind of embody that in a lot of ways, since they have their...
Yeah, they're all, scientists, but all, really spiritual at the same time, it seems.
Yep.
But they're... Yeah, it's they have, a religion of logic.
Right.
which kind of seems...
That's true, but...
a contradiction to... I'll go ahead and say that.
Arguably,
that sounds like a contradiction to me.
Yeah, arguably it's not on faith, though, because they've seen the practical effects of logic. They see that the science works as... what was it? It works, bitches? That's Dawkins' thing?
Yeah. But they also said that they'll focus on some more exploration-type stuff, which is kind of... Burnham kind of gives, their mission statement about, yeah, this is the United Federation of Planets. We go and explore. And so it sounds like we'll get more of that in season two. So.
Yeah. Well, it's what she and Stamets hoped to return to at times over the course of the first season, and now they're going to get their shot.
Yeah, so we have, it sounds like, a much more lighthearted second season. It doesn't sound like it'll be dark wartime stuff.
Yeah. I expect it to maintain its edge.
I'm sure it will.
If they... that they won't hesitate to have villains that do fairly heinous things, to acknowledge genocides and like other the bad kind of stuff that they run into. I think will feel the collateral damage more than is sometimes traditional in Star Trek, where it's pretty easy to say, oh, the Doomsday Machine destroyed a whole planet, or the giant amoeba destroyed a whole galaxy.
Yeah, we'll have gruesome deaths, we'll have people eating each other.
Yeah.
It'll be fun.
Yes. but yeah, I believe they will continue to show the consequences of violence and bad people that they have been doing.
So, we're running extremely long.
Yep.
But there's a lot to cover.
Are you going to tell your story?
I'm going to tell my story about like the Klingon makeup.
Okay.
So, on the cruise ship, alcohol is kind of expensive. It's like $9 a beer.
Right. You're a hostage there. You have to take whatever they offer.
Well, you can bring wine or champagne on board, but it has to be like sealed, and you have to pay like a $15 corkage fee to bring it on.
Okay. What word did you just say?
Corkage?
Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Okay, I don't know anything.
But I didn't know that until like a month ago. But
all right, I'm with you.
Well, my girlfriend is an accountant, and she's a super tight ass and hates to spend money.
Yeah.
So
it's good to have someone in the mix who's like that. Yeah.
You know, she bought a wine bottle, poured out the wine, loaded it up with vodka, sealed the bottle. she got sick on the cruise and couldn't enjoy the alcohol that we brought.
Uh-huh.
So, so I finally just opened up this vodka.
Yeah.
Drink it, as a Klingon.
Uh-huh.
And, this is the one night of the cruise where I was mixing it with lemonade. Because you can get lemonade for free on the ship.
Nice.
And, I got super messed up that night. The one night of the cruise that I did.
Yeah.
Made it back to my cabin. My girlfriend, who I mentioned, was sick. She was laying in bed, trying to recover.
You could have been caring for her. Instead, you were getting loaded.
Yes. And
does that sound very Federation?
Well, I was a Klingon.
Oh, right.
I was walking around with a Klingon prosthetic on my forehead.
Right.
Made it back to the cabin. Don't really remember going back, but I ended up there. And didn't quite make it into the bed. So I'm like passed out like on the floor, like on my knees next to the bed with my face like face down onto the bed. And so my girlfriend wakes up to see what looks like a Klingon in like a prayer position praying the Kalos.
Oh my god, that's pretty great. So that's why you're bruised. Just bashed your head with the nearest lamp. No, that's pretty excellent. I'm sure you've given her a permanent phobia, so that's really cool of you. No, that's pretty good.
What? So that's gonna wrap it up for Star Trek Discovery,
That's our first season.
Yeah, well, I take that back. We will be probably next week, hopefully doing a round table with some of our previous Tech Trek guests talking about just our overall thoughts of season one.
Yep.
And, after that, we got a lot planned out for the rest of the year. We're going to talk about Star Trek Discovery Desperate Hours, which has more relevance now than ever before.
Yep.
We got some Mirror Universe stuff to talk about. We're going to talk about the Mirror Universe comics. We actually have an interview with the artist on there, J.K. Woodward. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk about some Mirror Universe episodes from the other Trek shows. And we're going to talk about some Deep Space Nine stuff, because this is the 25th anniversary of Deep Space Nine.
Yep.
So a lot of Tech Trek content coming out this year. Be sure that you're following us on Facebook and Twitter and subscribed on YouTube.
Yeah, or checking out
our audio-only podcast on TechTrek.com.
Yes. Sorry, I talked over you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, for those who made it this far, thanks. This is like 37 episodes. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Not just, it's been very Discovery-focused, but, we preluded in with a lot of talk about the movies. We'll continue to talk about some more of the movies. And zero in on episodes.
We haven't talked about movies yet.
Well, we talked about pilots.
So that we can see how they compare to Discovery's pilot.
Right.
But yeah, we will talk about the Star Trek movies. We're gonna do a spotlight on each of the 13 Star Trek movies.
And although we're about to do an episode that will focus on the show as an overview, I'm interested to hear what people are thinking on this final episode. This is a good time to reflect back on the series as a whole, but do you buy the reveals in this? What do you think of the Constitution's look? Would you have genocided the Klingons? Would you have let Captain Georgiou or Emperor Georgiou just go? I mean, that's the one where I would have been, like, morally compromised, and I'd be like, just shoot her as soon as she leaves orbit.
Yeah, and if there's anything that you want to ask us or feel like you should bring to our attention before we do our Season 1 overview next week, then let us know, leave a comment. We might quote you on the show and respond to your question or read your comment. We
could even mock it.
Yeah, we might make fun of it, so don't say anything stupid or we'll totally make fun of
it. Please make fun of it.
Yeah, well, we say a lot of stupid stuff, so feel free to make fun of us in the comments also.
This episode has a lot of stuff you could take out of context. It's the two dickinest episode of them all.
Two dick, Klingon, Klet, whatever the hell you're talking about.
What?
You have a weird imagination, Dave.
Dude, that is biological.
Who are you to say Tyler needs therapy? I think you need it.
I'll deny that. One moment.
Well, we'll close on that note. Until next time, live long and prosper, y'all. Thank all of you so much for checking out this installment of Tech Trek. I hope you enjoyed it. Please be sure to like our YouTube videos and subscribe to our channel. Audio-only versions of episodes are available at our website, www.tex-trek.com. Please check out our site, especially if you just want an audio-only podcast. We have that available for you. Y'all can also keep up with us online. You can follow us on Twitter, at TXTrek, or you can check us out on Facebook at www.facebook.com/tex-trek. Please, by all means, let us know what you think by dropping a comment anywhere you see fit. We definitely want to hear your feedback. Let us know what you liked and what you would like to see more of, what you would like to see differently going forward. If you want to email me directly, go ahead. I can be reached at fatheryactual@tex-trek.com. Thank all y'all again. Take care.